Hello, I'm Dominic Arkwright. Every week we're going to bring you news and views about, well, life. We'll be talking to doctors, nurses, celebrities, and to people like you and me about everything to do with our health, our lifestyles, and our health service. We're here to help you get well if you're not, and stay well if you are. We're here to help you get the most out of life and the NHS. This week, sleep. Are you getting enough? Does it really matter if you're not? And what can you do to give yourself the best chance of a good night's sleep? We're talking about diabetes. Why are so many children getting the type normally associated with adults? Smoking, the actress Linda Robson, on her successful battle to stop, and an expert with the first of many useful tips to help you and me. And time to get your flu jab if you haven't had one. We talked to a leading GP about how to get one and why it matters. Also, some tips on how to build exercise into your life without even really trying. The number of children and teenagers with type 2 diabetes, that's the one normally associated with obesity, has jumped dramatically in the past 20 years. Experts are calling it an emerging epidemic. The thing is, the earlier you get diabetes, the more likely it is you'll get some of the complications when you're older, which can be very serious. So, what's going on? Why are children now getting type 2 diabetes? I've been speaking to Professor Timothy Barrett, a consultant in paediatrics at Birmingham Children's Hospital.
So, as I'm sure many of our listeners know, diabetes in children is usually actually type 1, which is where the pancreas doesn't work and people need to have insulin for life. Here we're talking really about type 2 or adult type diabetes in children, which is quite different. And this is really related often to weight problems such as obesity. And we've really been seeing this type of diabetes in children for about the last 14 years or so. In fact, the first cases were described here in Birmingham 14 years ago. And now we've developed a clinic just dedicated to these children where we see them about every 2 months.
Why is it happening?
Probably because changes in lifestyle over the last 20 or 30 years or so, and this is usually relating to children because their diet has changed and their levels of activity have changed over that time. So if you look at the diet first of all, people are not necessarily eating more, but they're eating more high calorie dense foods. So often these might be takeaway foods, such as from the local kebab shop or others, drinking fizzy drinks with a lot of glucose in them as well. And then if you think about burgers and those sorts of things, often they've got quite a high calorie density compared to boiled vegetables or boiled potatoes. So children get in a much greater number of calories for the same volume of food as before. The other aspect of this is really exercise, and this relates to children having fewer opportunities for exercise in today's schools. Partly that's related to less availability of playing fields. Also concerns about children cycling or walking to school on their own because of perceived danger either on the roads or from strangers around. So more children are being driven to school or catching the bus. And then, of course, in their spare time, children engage in much more sedentary activity than they did, using computers, PlayStations, and, of course, mobile phones. So the opportunities for perhaps going out and playing football or kicking a ball around are perhaps less.
It does seem that the 21st century is kind of conspiring to make us all more overweight.
I think there are lifestyle changes that have occurred in the adult population that are being projected down into children as well. And children today are probably undertake less exercise than they did 20 or 30 years ago. And our diets have changed as well. So that to solve this, it's really a whole society approach.
Some people are going to think, well, type 2 diabetes isn't really the serious one. I've heard a lot of people say that. What's your view?
So from Birmingham Children's Hospital here, we've led a national cohort, a study of type 2 diabetes in children, and we're currently following up a couple of hundred children with this at the moment. What we believe from data in Japan and Canada is that children developing diabetes of this type in their early teens are likely to go on and develop problems with their kidneys, perhaps in their 20s and 30s, have a high rate of miscarriage if they're female when they want to get pregnant in their 20s, and then probably go on to get cardiovascular disease in their 40s. So you have to remember that this disease isn't curable at the moment, and so children developing it at that age have got a whole lifetime to develop all the complications. If you're a 50 or 60, you may never get the complications. So it's a major problem for children.
Tell me a bit more about the complications, because there are problems with eyes, with feet, with nerves.
So the studies we've done here in Birmingham really have been looking at the rate of complications we've seen across. And we see probably about half the children will have high blood pressure already in childhood at the moment. About 20 to 30% will go on to get problems in their eyes within the next 15 years that time, and also kidneys at the same time as well. And because diabetes is only one consequence of obesity, these children often get other obesity-related complications as well, such as non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, problems with their joints from wear and tear from carrying the additional weight there as well, and other aspects particularly affecting their mood, such as a high prevalence of depression and altered low self-esteem and altered body image. It's important to say that most children who are overweight or obese don't actually want to be overweight or obese, and we probably don't diagnose the amount of depression in that population enough.
Professor Timothy Barrett, and you can hear more of that interview, in fact, more of almost everything you hear in these programmes, by searching on the NHS Choices website. We'll be talking to Professor Barrett again in another programme about what we can do to prevent our children getting diabetes, and later in this programme, a simple way of getting some activity into your life, walking to school. We'll hear what children think of that.
I like seeing our friends on the way.
Patrick, what do you like about walking to school?
Finding lots of different kinds of leaves.
Giving up smoking is the single most effective thing we can do to improve our chances of a healthy life. But it's incredibly hard. We'll be bringing you tips and advice over the next few weeks to help you in your efforts to quit. So there'll be plenty of expert advice, but sometimes the best encouragement comes from people who've done it. And we'll start with the actress Linda Robson, star of the TV programmes Birds of a Feather and Loose Women.
I started smoking on a school trip when I was probably about 12 or 13. We were all going away with the school for a week. We were going to Bath, and we all decided, you know, how you just want to do something grown up when you're that age. And we just all said we'd smoke for the school trip and then we'd stop as soon as we got back. Well, we never stopped. I never stopped smoking for years and years and years. And then at 34, found out I was pregnant and stopped smoking for 17 years. And then on my 50th birthday, I went out with a lot of friends and everyone got up to have a cigarette. My kids were there as well. So all the most interesting people seemed to go out for cigarettes. So I went out with them and I just had a cigarette and the kids were laughing and taking pictures of me because they'd never seen me smoke, you know. And then after another course, everyone got out to have another cigarette and I went out and had a cigarette. And within about 1 or 2 weeks, I'd actually bought a packet of cigarettes and then went back to like 30, 40 a day. It was like I had all those years to catch up on. And I had a really, really bad cough and it was making me miserable because the kids didn't know I was smoking, so I was sneaking off all the time to smoke. Couldn't wait for adverts in, you know, television programmes so I could go out and have a cigarette. And I was, you know, walking the dog all the time just so I could have a cigarette. Like, and it, everything became about smoking because it just gets you, like, straight away. And it's been probably about 4 years now since I've had a cigarette, and I would never ever have even a puff again. I'm still on nicotine replacement, but so it's still got the nicotine, so I'm still addicted to that, but it hasn't got any of the carbon monoxide, the poisonous gases, the tar, you know, like, so I'm happy with that at the moment, but I would like to eventually come off of that. But the other thing that that made me want to stop smoking is my daughter had been trying for a baby for 2 years, and she kept saying to me, when I have this baby, you're not looking after the baby if you're still smoking. So that gave me the incentive to stop. Also, my dad, who's 57, I'm 56 now, he died of lung cancer at 57. So I remember at the time, so that was 18 years ago, thinking he was quite old. Now I've got to that age myself, you think, no, actually, that was really young. So that was another reason to pick up smoking because, you know, I think also when you've had a... I love my children and my husband more than life itself, but when you've had a grandchild, it changes everything because you just want to be around for them. She gives me so much pleasure, all of us, so much pleasure, that I just want to be able to be there with her for as long as possible.
Tell me about quitting then. How did you first... quit?
I got approached to do this programme called Celebrity Quitters, when there was five celebrities and you could use anything you wanted. You had all the help that you needed, all the help that anyone can get, like going to a smoke, you know, packing up a smoking clinic. And first of all, they gave us patches and that didn't seem to work because it's like that's going in all the time. So when you needed that hit of nicotine, so they gave us this nasal spray, which is quite expensive. It's like £21 for one of those nasal sprays. But if you go to a smoking clinic, you actually get them free or on prescription. But so what it does is you just squirt it up your nose and it just gives you a hit of nicotine. So when people go out to have a cigarette, I'll take my nicotine replacement out with me and just have a squirt. And that takes away the craving for a cigarette.
What was the worst time, the worst period when you were quitting?
I'd say, like, you know, when you pack up, that's all you think about all the time. It's like it's on your mind constantly. You're looking at people thinking, oh, that looks so lovely, you know, like, and the smell of cigarettes as well. I love the fresh smell. Even now, if someone's smoking outside the studios, I'll walk over and have a little sniff or whatever. But like, over night time would be really hard. Like, after you've had something to eat, then normally you'd finish it with a cigarette, and then there's no cigarette there. So, but then probably after about two or three months, I'd say, you think, oh my God, I'm not thinking about it constantly. It's actually, it's gone away now. And then from looking at people and envying them, you're then pitying them. You think, oh, like, you poor soul, you're still smoking, you know. Because what I learned on the programme as well is they took us to a hospital, Heveld Hospital, and we saw people that had lung cancer or different cancers all related to smoking, and they'd then stopped smoking once they'd got the disease. You know, they'd left it too late, really, to stop, and they were all on exercise machines and things. And I think when you go somewhere like that and see people struggling to breathe and people, you know, like on their last legs and that, it does give you the incentive to stop.
The nicotine replacement therapy was really the key, was it?
Yeah, it was, because, it, you know, lots of people do it cold turkey, and I was offered all these different things, the same as anyone's offered. If they go, if you go along to your doctor's surgery, you can all get the help that you need.
You think that's a good thing?
I think it is a good thing. I think, you know, that people do need, it's like Weight Watchers, it's like any of those diet things. When you're going to a class every week and you're getting weighed, or you're talking about packing up smoking or whatever, and you're all in the same boat and you're all helping each other and telling each other how difficult it is a lot of the time. So I think it does help to be in, like, not therapy, but in a room where everyone's going through the same thing. And also the money it costs you, you know, like, when you think, so when I first packed up, I'd put the money that I would spend on cigarettes into something and go and have a massage or do something nice, get my feet done or something, have a little treat for, you know, for doing so well.
How do you feel now?
Oh, I feel, you know, I haven't coughed since I packed up smoking. I know people think, you know, I'm probably exaggerating, but I used to get up and have a cigarette and then I'd be coughing, and it's disgusting, and spitting, you know, like, because it's phlegm and that there. I obviously haven't, you know, stopped or changed any of the damage that I did to myself smoking, but it hasn't got any worse, because that's what lots of people go, oh, the damage is done now. Well, no, you can stop it. You can stop, and then obviously you can't change what you've done, but you can stop it from getting worse.
What's your message to young people who maybe haven't started?
Don't do it. Don't smoke, because once it gets you, it's really, really hard. I mean, I've seen people do stupid things. I myself, like when I was younger, I'd go out at 2 o'clock in the morning to get a packet of cigarettes, whereas I'd never dream of doing that for anything else but for the cigarettes, or going down an ashtray, you know, like an ashtray indoors and finding a dog in because I haven't got a cigarette, you know, like things that you would never dream of doing. But when you've got that in your head, it's like you'd do anything for a cigarette.
So don't start.
So don't start. Don't start, because you don't know how hard it's going to be to stop.
The lovely Linda Robson, and she made it. Well, you and I may not get the opportunity to be involved in a celebrity quit smoking programme. If you don't get the call, why not try something that's available to all of us? Professor Robert West is Director of Tobacco Studies at University College London, and over the next few weeks, we'll be picking his brains about what can make a difference. Today, medicines. You do it for a cold, so why not to help you quit smoking? Your GP can help.
The first thing to note is that if you feel ready to quit today, do it today. Don't wait. A lot of people think you need to plan ahead in order to be able to have a successful quit attempt. But our research tells us very clearly that strike while the iron is hot is the key message. Because there's things you can do after you've put the quit attempt into place that can then make a difference to getting started well. But if you're going to set a quit date for some time in the future, make it sooner rather than later, ideally within the next couple of weeks. And the reason for that is, as we know with so many things in life, you go off the boil. What seems like a good idea now then becomes a less good idea as time goes on. The other thing I would say is that we're now getting quite a lot of research coming in telling us that it's not a particularly good idea to cut down gradually and, you know, take out your cigarettes one at a time. In fact, you're probably best off smoking your head off or whatever feels comfortable until that point at which you've decided this is it, this is the break point. Because what you're trying to do is to create that division between your past life as a smoker and your future life as a non-smoker. And as you cut down further and further and further, it becomes harder and harder. You take more and more nicotine in from each cigarette, and each one becomes more rewarding. And then very often you don't make it to getting rid of that last cigarette. So that's an important thing as well. The other thing I would say, which I can't emphasize strongly enough, is that it really makes sense to use the NHS Stop Smoking services. They were set up more than 10 years ago on the basis of very strong evidence that I and many others had been collecting over the years that they do make a difference. They're not a guarantee of success. Nothing is in life, let alone in smoking cessation, but they can improve your chances. So it really makes a difference. You may have tried them in the past and not really got on terribly well, or you felt that the person you spoke to wasn't really right for you, or they didn't seem that good. Don't worry about that, actually. There's lots of different specialists out there, and it's like anything. You know, some people you get on with, some people you don't. But in general, you know, the chances are you will find someone who is actually right for you.
And you're four times as likely to be able to stop successfully.
That's right.
If you get that help.
That's right. That's right. And it's not just the behavioural support, as we call it. It's very practical advice from someone who's seen it all before. You know, they've seen, you know, in many cases, hundreds of smokers. And so they know what you're going through, and they can give you advice from that experience and from the research that we've conducted as how you can deal with the difficult situations and so on. But the other side of it, of course, is the stop smoking medicines. Now, I know a lot of people don't want to take medicines at all, let alone for something like stopping smoking. And I know also that some people feel, well, you know, I should do it myself. It's to do with the ego. You know, you feel you should be strong enough. Well, you could, you know, take that view. But if that means you're going to go back to smoking and die of lung cancer, that's not that clever. You know, for me, if I get a headache, I take an aspirin or paracetamol. Why wouldn't I? It's ridiculous to suffer when you don't have to. And same with smoking. And the stop smoking medicines really make a difference. There's three that are in common use. There's two pills, and then there's the familiar nicotine replacement therapy, patches and so on. Of the pills, the ones that we would now always recommend are Champix or varenicline. Sounds a bit like a dog food, but it's the brand name for this drug that's been developed specifically to help people stop smoking. And what it does is the chemical looks a bit like nicotine. So when you take it in, it attaches itself to the parts of the brain, the receptors in the brain that nicotine would normally attach to, and it sits on them so that the nicotine can't get there. So that what you find, even if you take this drug and you're still smoking, is that it doesn't really do anything for you. It's not hitting the spot, and it can't hit the spot because the Champix is sitting there on the receptor. But it's also very good at controlling the cravings.
You're actually encouraged to keep smoking for a little bit while you're taking this drug?
Yes, you smoke for about a week or so while you take the drug. And the reason for that is that you start on a lower dose of the drug and then you come up to the proper dose. And the reason for that is it takes a while for the drug concentrations to build up in the system, and you want to ease yourself into it gradually. And in fact, there's some new research which suggests that if you give yourself an even longer lead-in period, maybe 2 weeks or longer, you may even get better results. And the reason for that is that it gives your brain longer to get used to the idea that smoking isn't actually doing anything for you. So Champix is a very effective drug. And if you haven't tried that, and if you struggled to stop in the past, then I think that's something, you know, well worth considering. And your stop smoking advisor would tell you all about it.
What's the other one?
The other pill is one called Zyban, which has been around an awful long time. It's a very, very mild stimulant. If you think of it as like a sort of almost like a cup of coffee in a pill form, but stimulating the parts of the brain that you need to for helping with cravings and cigarette withdrawal. But it's a very good stop smoking drug. It's not as good as Champix, to be honest. There have been head-to-head trials which have found that Champix does outperform Zyban. But it has a different mechanism of action. So if you tried Champix and it really did nothing for you, then Zyban could be an option.
You said that just talking to NHS Stop Smoking Services could increase your chances of being successful four times. What about taking these medicines?
Well, these medicines are part of that package. It would be very unusual for you to go to the Stop Smoking Service and not take a drug. I mean, or nicotine replacement therapy. So what you get is about a doubling with the behavioural support, the advice, and then you get about another doubling roughly with the medicines or the nicotine replacement therapy that you're getting. So you put the two together and that's where you get this huge improvement in success rates.
Professor Robert West with advice that it really does help if you go and see your doctor. More on that on the smoking pages on the NHS Choices website and more on this programme as we go along. Now, this is a subject close to my heart, sleep. We've all got to do it, but how much do we actually need? Margaret Thatcher and Napoleon, coincidentally, got by on very little. My daughter, who's 19, on the other hand, feels cheated by less than 14 hours a night. If you suffer from insomnia, you might be grateful for just 4. So why are our needs so different? And what are the potential dangers of not getting enough sleep? I'll be talking to sleep expert Dr. Michelle Needham in a minute. But first, some thoughts from a nurse, Jacqueline Kubis, who, like many people, including me, works night shifts as well as days and finds it hard to adjust.
Over the last 3.5 years, I've done days and nights. More recently, I've done days since stepping up to become a sister. But I do still work nights when it's required. And we work full over 7 days a week.
Which do you prefer, days or nights?
Days, definitely.
Okay, so how do you adjust between doing days 1 week, maybe, and nights the next?
I used to find it okay, actually, when I first started. But over the last few years, I've found it more difficult to go from days to nights. I found that I've needed longer off to adjust and to be able to feel like I'm fit to work, really. But certainly I find that I'm far more sleepy and not just on the ball as much after I've been doing nights.
That's not so good, though, is it, for a nurse to be not on the ball during a shift?
I think that's why you've got to be aware, really, if you are up to the task and fit for work. We work very hard to make sure that those who we know struggle more with adjusting from days to nights have longer off.
What do you do? If you're about to start a series or even just one night shift, how do you play the day before?
What I try to do, and I know quite a few of my colleagues will do, is we will stay up later the night before. So then obviously I tend to probably stay up to about 1, 2 in the morning, try and lie until at least lunchtime of, you know, the night of my shift. So then I don't find that I'm tired until sort of the early hours or coming up to the end of my shift. I find that works for me quite well and for some of my colleagues.
And what about in between? Because you've got to sleep during the day and that's not quite normal, natural anyway.
I've recently moved house actually, and because it's a lot noisier during the day, I find that's more difficult because I'm being woken up, you know, from, you know, environmental noises, etc. But normally I'm not too bad. I can sleep pretty well for a good 10, 12 hours. I do find after nights I need a longer period of sleep than what I do when I'm working day shifts.
Nurse Jacqueline Kubis. Dr. Michelle Needham is a respiratory physician at Salford Royal Hospital with a particular interest in sleep. I asked her first how much it's normal to need.
I think the short answer is we don't know. Sleep is probably a lot more complicated than we think and probably has lots of benefits to the body. We know that all mammals sleep and we all have our own experience of our own sleep. But we think it's part of our body recovering, our body processing what's happened to us in the day. And certainly in terms of our development in early life, our forming our memories and the neuronal networks which help us to remember things and work things out.
So our bodies and our minds sorting out what's happened during that day and preparing for the future.
Absolutely.
What happens if you don't get enough?
Well, there might be short-term problems with that, and I think we've all probably experienced a night without sleep and we might feel quite grotty, moody in the morning. But over time, if you are constantly sleep-deprived and not getting the amount of sleep that you need, it can affect not only your physical functioning in terms of your work, your ability to perform tasks, but also your mood, your memory, your relationships, and I think it's really important in every aspect of our lives.
Well, tell me a bit more about that. I mean, obviously, if you're not making, if it affects your judgment, you're not going to be so good at your job.
Absolutely, and that doesn't matter what sort of job you perform. Most of us, in our work, we need a certain amount of concentration of various sorts, and if you are sleep deprived, you are more likely to have lapses in your concentration.
What about your mood and your judgment and your how you feel about yourself?
It certainly can affect mood, and also having a mood condition itself can affect sleep, so they're closely interlinked. And usually the lack of sleep depresses your mood. It makes you more sluggish, it makes you feel more depressed and perhaps more anxious rather than elated. That's an unusual reaction to the lack of sleep, I think.
Well, I remember a colleague of mine when I worked night shifts, you say after the third night shift is when you start crying at sad songs.
That would be a good example. Certainly.
But it really does affect your mood, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it absolutely can.
How much do people need?
It varies with individuals and for reasons we don't fully understand, but it's probably linked with the genes that we carry, so it's a preset determinant in all of us. And I think if you ask most people if they had the opportunity to, how they would sleep, we could probably guess ourselves of how much as individuals we need. I know I need about 9 hours, so I don't often get it, but that's my sleep need. My husband is a shorter sleeper and can... only needs about 6 hours. So I think it's preset, and you've probably got a good idea yourself of what your sleep need is.
And there's something called circadian rhythms, which are individual to people. What are they?
So a circadian rhythm is where our body is doing different things over a 24-hour day. And one of the strongest drivers of us wanting to sleep is the release of a hormone called melatonin. And that's released more in higher volumes from a central part of our brain when it's not exposed to light. So in human beings that are working in the day, our melatonin levels will go up higher in the night, and that will make us feel sleepy.
So the hormone is making you sleepy?
It does. Of course, a lot of things that we do, staying up at night or trying to work night shifts, are against this hormone. And this signal from the hormone is stronger in some people than others.
Well, what about people who do have to work night shifts?
So, again, I've worked night shifts myself, as a lot of my colleagues have, and you will see a spectrum of people. So some people work very well at night and actually choose to become permanent night workers. And I think one common theme they have is that they have a good ability to flip their sleep time from nighttime to the daytime. So they can come back from a night shift and go to bed and have a good chunk of sleep. Whereas people that have a stronger or seem to react more strongly to the melatonin signal find it harder to fight against that and will have less deep sleep and perhaps less length of sleep during the day.
So you've got to be pretty careful about who you put on a night shift if you're a boss.
Yes, I think we're becoming increasingly aware, and over recent years there's been in the medical literature some evidence about other health problems that can be related with shift work. So I think we've got a lot more to learn about it.
Like what?
Well, for instance, the Scandinavian researchers have found an increased risk of breast cancer in shift workers, actually nurses they looked at, who have worked shifts and nights over a long period of time. Now, why that is, we don't know.
Anything else?
There have been some studies looking at length of life, and again, people that are having less sleep because perhaps of working shifts, that might reduce your life expectancy. It's not enough evidence for us to really look at this in our workplaces yet, but I think over the next few years we'll find out more about it.
Dr. Michelle Needham, and in another programme we'll be talking about sleepwalking, sleep talking and other sleep disorders. OK, it's that time of year. Coughs, colds and flu. Millions of vaccinations will be given this year, and if you're at risk, you've probably had a call from your GP. If you haven't and you think you want one, this is for you. Dr. James Kingsland is a GP and President of the National Association of Primary Care.
The focus is on, first of all, demographics. So we are trying to, in our practices, give vaccinations to all the over 65s, all children under 18s, or where patients have another long-term condition. So it might be diabetes, a chronic musculoskeletal disease.
Because they're more at risk of flu.
Yes, or the consequences of getting flu, heart disease, chronic chest problems, both asthma and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. So we'll be focusing on those which we call long-term conditions. Also, if you are in a particular residential situation where you're at higher risk. So residential and nursing home care, not only because of the age, but the nature of transmission. And finally, a group that is going to be targeted on an annual basis are pregnant women, because we know immune systems are slightly compromised and there's benefits for both the pregnant woman and their unborn baby. We know that from about October through till March is the peak incidence, and that's why we try to vaccinate against that particular season. The reason why it's done on an annual basis is because the virus mutates, it changes every year, so that's why we have to vaccinate every year.
Does the vaccine work?
It's effective in to try and promote your own immune system to recognise the influenza virus and then work more quickly and reduce the symptoms of flu. We don't expect it to prevent flu in all cases, and the vaccines that are produced are the best vaccine against the viruses or the strains of the virus that we think will be hitting our shores around now.
So how do I go about getting a flu jab?
Well, if you're in one of the higher risk groups, your general practitioner will be doing an active call-in system, so most general practitioners will be identifying those target groups. If you're outside of the target group, it's difficult. There may be instances where it is available on the NHS, but for many, because of the supply, the numbers that we've got to vaccinate, we are only focusing on those target groups.
Well, how many is it? I mean, millions?
Oh, yes, we'll be looking at within those age groups and the particular patients with long-term conditions. There'll be, in a practice like mine with just under 6,000 patients. Last Saturday, we vaccinated 800 people in one go. That's the first cohort. We're probably going to be doing at least double that.
Is there anyone who shouldn't have a flu vaccination?
Well, we've got to be careful whether you've got certain allergies, so an egg allergy, it's just the way the vaccine is produced. So there are alternatives. If you've got a severely compromised immune system where there may be dangers of having vaccines, but again, the general practice will identify those at high risk who should have and those at high risk who maybe would be excluded because of their particular nature and their immune system.
Dr. James Kingsland. We heard earlier in this programme about the problem of children with diabetes. It's well known that exercise, or at least some kind of activity, is one of the best defences against the condition. But of course, it's also good for your child's general health, and yours for that matter. Walking to school has been promoted recently as a good way for families to build exercise into their daily routine. Our reporter Isabel Eaton took her microphone along on the walk to school with her children in Frome in Somerset.
Grace, you need to get your shoes on. Come on. Okay. Everybody ready? Okay, let's go. Right, now we're off. It's 8:30 on a lovely, bright autumn morning, and we're off to school with Patrick, who's 5, and Grace, who's 7. And we do try to walk to school most mornings, if we have the time. It's not a long walk, about 15 minutes. So, Grace, what do you like about walking to school?
I like seeing our friends on the way.
Patrick, what do you like about walking to school?
Finding lots of different kinds of leaves.
Lots of different kinds of leaves. Yeah, you do like to collect things, don't you? Let's cross here quickly. And once we've finished the trafficy bit of town, we turn off into a much quieter street. Hello.
Hello.
So we run into Steph and Vivi this morning. We're just asking people about walking to school. How often do you walk to school?
Ooh, well, let me see. Probably about twice a week, because there are 3 days I'm working.
And do you enjoy walking to school?
Yeah, it's lovely. It's a really nice walk. It's pretty safe, this one.
What about you, Viv? Do you enjoy walking to school?
Yeah, I like getting fresh air.
Now, I see your mum today. She's wearing her running gear. So do you kind of fold walking to school with some other kind of exercise?
Yeah, absolutely. Drop them off and then I run the long way home.
So that's your tip, walk to school, run home.
That's it.
Angus, hello.
Hello.
You're here with a very fancy scooter. Tell me about your journey to school.
We usually walk, but sometimes drive.
Which do you prefer?
Walking, because it's slower and I like walking.
Right, let's talk to this lady here. Good morning.
Good morning.
How many days do you manage walking to school?
I walk to school every day.
And how long does it take you?
Well, it depends which way we go and what mood we're in, but usually about 20 minutes.
Does it impact on the rest of your day in terms of time?
Yeah, it does. I drop them off and then I have to go straight home, get in the car, drive to work, and I'm usually between 5 and 10 minutes late every day, but it's expected, so I'm consistent with it.
There's another incentive for us to walk to school, isn't there? Because the parking around our school is pretty dreadful.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was very stressful when we were going up in the car any time. You're just scratching around to find spaces. And it actually, with all the roadworks, it takes just as long.
It's sometimes actually easier to walk, isn't it?
It is.
So, Peter,
yes.
Walking to school, see you most mornings. You're pretty hardy, actually. I have to say, I've seen you many days when the rain's coming down. You don't make any distinction, do you? You go whatever the weather.
No, it's probably my scouting background. It's the wrong clothes rather than the wrong weather. It's a much nicer experience walking, even if it's in the rain.
That's a very admirable approach. OK, we better go, because we're all going to be late otherwise. Oh, so we're climbing up now. We're coming up past the church. Lots of steps. We go round the side of the church. So this is part of the morning ritual. They like to run through the graveyard. And then the path goes very, very steeply up the side. It's an alley, really, cobbled, where we get to school. And they like to jump off the wall here. Come on then, everyone, jump down. So we're in the way, so everything's happening. So we've got scaffolding as well. So tell me, how often do you walk to school?
Every day, there and back, without fail.
Whatever the weather?
Yes, absolutely.
And how long is your walk?
So it's 20 minutes each way.
And what are the benefits of walking to school?
It's just it's a really lovely period of time to be able to talk with your little one. We were just talking about dreams on the way here, that sort of thing. It's a calming time, much less stressful than driving, I would imagine. Yeah. So a nice, calming, peaceful, chill-out time before school starts. And of course, fitness.
Well, yeah, especially coming up this last bit.
Yeah, it's great.
And Ted, do you enjoy the walk to school?
Yeah.
And you've got your scooter today?
Yeah.
Do you often scoot?
Yes, a lot of the time.
And what's the best bit about the walk to school?
Going down the hill after our house, because I can go on my scooter and it's really fast.
That's the thing about Zoom, isn't it? A lot of ups and downs in this town. Right, we're here. We better go in the gate and get everybody into class.
The NHS, as most of us know, is an amazing and unique organisation. We thought it'd be interesting to hear about the working lives of the many different and often unsung people whose skills and dedication make the NHS what it is. You see them when you're in hospital or in the GP waiting room, and you might wonder, what do you do? Today, a midwife in Wiltshire tells us about the work she does and the unusual way she chooses to spend her holidays.
I'm Beryl Orchard. And I work as the Clinical Midwifery Manager, otherwise known as Matron, for Trowbridge Birth Centre and Chippenham Birth Centre. I became a midwife in 1978, and I've had a wonderful time as a midwife. I'm extremely passionate about midwifery, and I've worked all of my life as a midwife. 9 years ago, I had the privilege to be invited to go to West Africa to a village in Senegal as part of a team from my church to do some voluntary work in a school for missionary children. Prior to going, I thought, wouldn't it be good to have a look around and see what the healthcare is like in that area? So I did some research and I made contact with UNICEF, and it was arranged that I would meet a social worker there. On my second day in Senegal, a social worker came on a little pop-pop bike, motorbike, and she took me around what they call the health huts. And health huts are little huts that have been built in the villages, funded by UNICEF and other international partners, to ensure that women can go there and have a safe as possible birth. I was absolutely amazed by the experience, and I have been going back ever since on an annual basis. The catalyst for me wanting to go back was two, really. First of all, meeting the village midwife. She is a wonderful woman who has been there many, many years. She's nearly as old as me. And she oversees the maternity services for the area, for not only the village she lives in, but another five that satellite round that village. She trains the local birth attendants. And the other thing was that when I went to the health huts, the birth attendants were so proud of the instruments that they had. And in this health hut, there was a bed, an old metal bed, a leather bag hanging on the end of the bed. If a woman came in labour, the bag was taken to the well. The water was collected and heated, and then the instruments that they had were put into the water to sterilise. However, the instruments were rusty. And I immediately thought, wouldn't it be great if this village and the surrounding villages could have stainless steel instruments? So I then set about fundraising and managed by the following year to purchase enough instruments for the area. I went on from strength to strength each year, fundraising, purchasing more and more equipment and taking it to that area. And this is not me, it's a huge group of people who support me. As everyone knows, in the Western world, we are so privileged to have low, by comparison, maternal and neonatal mortality rates. In Senegal, I have witnessed at least one woman dying from eclampsia due to the fact there are no drugs there that she could be given. I've seen another woman lose two babies due to eclampsia and hemorrhage. If she had been in England, that she would be alive, and possibly so would her baby. So some of the things I see that are very tragic. However, it's not because the healthcare personnel don't try so hard. It's because they don't have the wherewithal to deal with the situations. The women are working right up until the time they have their babies. They have to, if they have a job, and they have to keep going. And my own caseload ladies would say to me, "Oh, Beryl, you're going to Senegal again. You won't have any sympathy for us, will you, when we come in moaning about it?" But I said, no, not quite true, because I am sympathetic and empathetic and really cared about the ladies in my caseload. But what I saw in Senegal put things into perspective. The midwives there work tirelessly and to help the local women. They don't work in the same way as we do, in that they have shifts. They're on call 24 hours a day, and it becomes part of their life. And they are so dedicated, and yet they don't have the resources that we have. They just usually just have their hands. The women there put all their trust in those midwives and birth attendants. I find it very humbling to watch what they do. And I come back to England and think, yeah, we complain so much. You know, the NHS is wonderful. It's free at the point where people need it. And, you know, and I'm so proud of our NHS in the UK. I'm planning on taking flexi retirement, which my boss does not believe. She can't see it happening, and neither can my family. But I have made the decision now that it's time to hand over the reins in my job to somebody else. And I want to finish my career as I started off, as what I call a proper jobbing midwife. I am absolutely passionate about midwifery. I love seeing new babies come into the world. I love caring for women during their pregnancy, during their labour and postnatally. I don't think there's a better job in the whole world, and I can't imagine ever doing anything else.
We hear a lot about breast cancer, prostate cancer, lung cancer, but who talks about mouth cancer? Well, it kills more people than cervical cancer and testicular cancer combined, and it's something we can prevent. And Fiona Osgoon is Health Information Officer for Cancer Research UK.
Well, it's sort of one of the less common cancers, but there's still about 5,500 cases we see each year in the UK. It's not so rare to be something that you shouldn't be thinking about.
I suppose the key thing is, what should I be looking out for?
Things like an ulcer or a sore in your mouth that won't heal. So that can be in your mouth or on your tongue as well.
A regular ulcer.
Yeah, so I think the thing that's important to note with all cancers really is that it's a change that doesn't go away. So it's really important to know what's normal for you. And as soon as anything isn't normal, to sort of take notice. And that's the thing that sort of should be a bit of a warning sign to people. So this is one of the tricky things with mouth cancer, is that an ulcer isn't something that for most people they would immediately worry about. And for good reason, many people get ulcers all the time. But it's something that doesn't heal and that's persistent, I think. So a change that's persistent persistent, like an ulcer that hasn't gone away for 3 weeks, is something that you wanted to maybe get checked out by your GP. Other things like discomfort or pain in your mouth or your tongue. And there's other sort of slightly more unusual things like a red or white patch in your mouth. So a change of the skin inside your mouth or your gums or tongue, just to sort of look out for. And these things you can look out for yourself. Also, your dentist can help you when you're getting a checkup. That's something that they look for anyway. So they'll look to see if there are any signs of cancer. So it's really important to make sure that you're attending your checkups, because it's not just sort of your dental health. It can be to do with sort of mouth cancer as well.
It's quite a tricky thing to look for yourself, isn't it?
Yeah, it can be sort of a difficult thing to look for, but I think it's one of the things is sort of having a little look in the mirror and just sort of checking, and also, again, really just making sure that if anything feels beyond what's normal for you, everyone's very different, so it's important to notice a change. And if you do notice a change, that's the sort of thing that you should be picking up on and sort of taking action on.
And if I do look in the mirror and I see a white or red spot, do I go to my GP, to my dentist? What do I do?
You can go to either. Sort of, if you've got a dental appointment anyway, they'll be happy to check. And you can always ask your dentist while you're there, you know, especially if you're in a sort of at-risk group, so people who drink alcohol and people who either smoke or use chewing tobacco are at higher risk of developing mouth cancer. So you can ask your dentist, you know, are you checking for signs of mouth cancer, just to sort of flag it to them that that's something that you might want to be aware of. If you notice any changes, it's always a really great idea to ring your GP and get an appointment. People often worry that they're going to be bothering their GP or wasting their time, but it's really important that you know your body best and you know what's not normal for you, and if there is anything that is sort of outside of what you'd expect to feel or sort of see in your mouth, then you go to your GP straight away.
Does it hurt necessarily? No.
It can do, so it can be it can hurt sort of within your mouth, and also you can get things like a sore or painful throat or sort of a croaky voice, difficulty swallowing, so anything that's sort of just a little bit unusual around your sort of mouth or the top of your throat really is something to look out for that hasn't gone away on its own, because obviously those can be things like a cold or a cough can cause. So it's that sort of persistent change that's one of the things to look out for.
And I suppose the key is to get it looked at as soon as possible.
Yeah, I think as soon as you notice that, you know, you've given it a couple of weeks and it hasn't cleared up on its own, that's the point at which you might want to sort of go to your GP and just get it checked. Most of the time, it's not going to be cancer. It'll be something relatively minor. But it's really important just to be safe and sort of have that safety of mind to know that, you know, it's been checked.
And if it is diagnosed as mouth cancer, what is the benefit of early diagnosis?
With all cancers, the earlier that we catch them, the better the survival rates. So that's true not just for mouth cancer, but sort of pretty much all of the cancers, really.
What is the survival rate of mouth cancer?
So the survival rate is about 50%. The overall cases are about 5,500, so it's about half of those people who were diagnosed with mouth cancer will go on to survive at least 5 years with their cancer.
And how does 5,500 people with mouth cancer compare with other types of cancer, which we hear certainly a lot more about?
Well, it is sort of, the rates are lower of mouth cancer, which obviously is something that we're really pleased about, but it is still prevalent and it is increasing. It's important to note. So the rates of mouth cancer are going up, and that's partly because of the things that cause it. So things like alcohol, chewing tobacco, smoking tobacco products. So that includes things like shisha as well, are all sort of contributing to this increase that we're seeing. So it is important to note that while it's low, that doesn't mean we can all sort of relax. We need to sort of tackle some of the factors that go into increasing mouth cancers.
So smoking, I think everyone could understand, but alcohol as a risk factor?
Yeah, alcohol's one that often people are surprised about, but it actually sort of increases risk for quite a lot of cancers, but especially of sort of the mouth, the throat and sort of stomach, because it's in direct contact with them.
So apart from stopping smoking, cutting or possibly quitting drinking, what else can I do to reduce my risk?
You can sort of look at your diet. So eating plenty of fruits and vegetables can help to reduce your risk of mouth cancer. And as a sort of added bonus to that, can help you reduce your risk of loads of other things as well. So lots of the other different types of cancer and obviously other diseases like heart disease, stroke, things like that. Having a healthy, balanced diet can really go a long way to helping you stay healthy.
That was Fiona Osgoode from Cancer Research UK. Right, one of the things we're really going to be doing in these programmes is helping you keep active. Might need a little more help from James Brown here. Get out of my- The government recommends 30 minutes of exercise 5 times a week, plus some other stuff. If you're like me, that sounds like rather a lot. We all know that exercise is good for us, but finding the time and the willpower to do it is a little tricky. The good news is that any amount of exercise will do you some good. We've been talking to Dr. Mike Loosemore, who's a consultant in sport and exercise medicine at the Institute of Sport, Exercise and Health at University College London. We'll have loads of little tips from him over the next few weeks, which really are encouraging. We're not talking about running 5K or half a marathon or going to the gym. We're talking about standing up during the advert breaks on TV. So, how to go from nothing to something? It all helps, and he'll tell us how. But first, here are Mike's thoughts on where we've been going wrong.
We are meant to be active. We are exercise monkeys. We have evolved to be an active monkey that runs around on the open savanna. An example of this is endurance hunting, which still goes on in Africa now. To endurance hunt, you start in the heat of the day, you find your buffalo, antelope, hairy mammoth, whatever, and you spook it, and so it runs, and you start chasing it. Humans have greater endurance than any other mammal, which means that you can spook your antelope, and it may run quickly at first, but you keep spooking it, and you keep running it after it, and eventually it becomes tired and exhausted and collapses, and it's easy to kill and eat. Our whole body has evolved to be active.
Tell me about the health benefits of being active.
The health benefits of moderate physical activity are really extraordinary. You can reduce your risk of getting certain diseases by a huge amount. For example, cardiovascular disease, heart attacks, you can reduce by 50%. Diabetes, type 2 diabetes, you can reduce by 50%. Breast cancer, you can also reduce by 50% by being active. You can reduce the risk of colon cancer by 60%. You can reduce the risk of Alzheimer's disease by a third. Physical activity is as effective as Prozac at reducing depression. And the thing is that this is not aimed at one disease in particular. It's not like a tablet that will, you know, if you do the activity, it'll help your diabetes, or it'll help your heart, or it'll stop you getting a stroke. It does all those things all at the same time.
So we're supposed to be hunting down antelopes on the plain. What's actually happened to us?
Over the last 100 years, there's been a sea change in how we use our bodies and how active we are. The whole of the 20th century has been about labour-saving devices, reducing physical activity. So now there are cars to go everywhere, there's transport that takes us virtually to the door, we have vacuum cleaners for cleaning rugs, we have washing machines for doing washing, we have sit-on lawnmowers for doing the lawn. There was a survey in America which looked at the activity of women in the household, and they found that even since 1964, the level of activity for women with young children has reduced by 14 hours a week, which is an enormous amount.
What about men?
The same applies for men. Most of the activity that men do is in their workplace. People think they get their physical activity outside work by going to the gym or playing football or whatever. But in fact, most activity historically has been within the workplace. Now, of course, and particularly over the last 15 years, the workplace has changed dramatically with the introduction of the computer and the computer screen, and the way that people now, when they go to work, sit in front of a computer screen and sit there being sedentary, being inactive all day. And this has made a huge difference to the way people can expend energy at work. Farm labouring and labouring generally, and these active manual jobs have virtually disappeared. Even if you're digging up the road now, you won't be using a pick and a shovel and being physically active. You'll be sitting down on a mini digger, just moving a couple of levers in either hand and doing the same job. I'm not saying that this is a bad thing for the people doing the work. But what I'm saying is that we've lost a huge amount of physical activity from our daily lives, and we really need to think about how we're putting that back, because our bodies need to be active. And when we're not active, we're getting all these diseases that we're concerned about, such as diabetes, obesity, cardiovascular disease, cancer, etc.
Dr. Mike Loosemore, and we have lots of tips about how to make exercise easy. Finally, it's always nice when people say thank you. You may wish it happened a lot more often than it does, but in healthcare, there are often life or death reasons for saying thank you. Yet it's not till after we've recovered from an illness or an accident that we think about the people who've helped us and wish we could have thanked them. Here, we're giving you that chance with a feature called, originally enough, Thank You.
Hello, I'm Michael Westbrook. I'm 36 years old. I'm a solicitor in my day job and a very keen cyclist on the weekend. And I'd like to thank the paramedics who treated me following a serious cycle injury earlier this year. I was cycling on a Sunday evening with a friend of mine, and we live in the countryside, and we were cycling around a country lane, and I was going quite fast, and out of nowhere came two badgers walking line astern, and I had really no chance to stop or swerve, and I hit one of them and went straight over the handlebars of my bike and probably hit the ground at about 25 miles an hour, which was quite painful. And I knew that something was wrong, and my friend who is with me said, do you want us to phone a neighbour or do you want to phone the ambulance? And I tried to move my arm, and really I thought that it was the ambulance was the best bet. And it turned out that I'd fractured, I had an open fracture on my right elbow. I'd also fractured my clavicle and shoulder socket and pretty bumped and bruised over a good part of the rest of my body. Stupidly, neither of us had our phones with us, and we went to find a local farmer who called the ambulance. And I mean, within about 15 or 20 minutes, there was a response car that came out, and she just put me at ease, tried to calm me down because I was going into physical shock at that stage, put a blanket around me, kept me warm. And within another, I'd say 15, 20 minutes or so, the full ambulance paramedics arrived, and they treated me in the ambulance on the side of the road for about half an hour. They gave me pain relief. As I say, I was in shock, but really put me at ease, and then drove especially gently back to not the local hospital, but the hospital in the nearest city. And I mean, it took a while, but they were going slowly so that I wasn't bumped around too much. I mean, the accident happened about 9 o'clock in the evening. It was about 11 o'clock by the time I got to the hospital, and they kept me in overnight because I had an open fracture. I was an infection risk, so I got operated on about 9 or 10 o'clock the following morning, kept in for a couple of days, and had another follow-up operation about a week later. All the care that I got was really impressive. I don't use the NHS very much, but then when I really did need it, there were, you know, they treated me really quickly and really well. The people that really stand out were the paramedics in the ambulance. I was in a bit of a bad way, but I just had some banter with them on between my accident and going back to the hospital, which was, you know, just put me at ease. So those would be the people I'd like to thank the most.
And thanks to the care he received, Mike is now fully recovered and back on his bike. That's all for this week. Next time, what's the problem with antibiotics? The early signs of dementia and how to spot them, and also how to choose a care home. Thank you for listening. Stay well.
The opinions expressed in this programme are the individual's own personal opinion and do not reflect the views or official policy of the Department of Health or NHS Choices. This programme was clinically reviewed in December 2014.